This is 1A. I'm Celeste Headley in Maryland. Momentous news from the Supreme Court today. The court has now ruled on a program that protects 700,000 DACA recipients. These are folks who came to America as children and did not knowingly break the law. We're talking about the fate of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals policy. It's better known as DACA. The program was created in 2012 under President Barack Obama. President Trump rescinded the program in 2017. And then today, the Supreme Court has ruled against the Trump administration. The case was a challenge to the decision to end DACA. The court says the decision by the Trump administration was arbitrary and capricious. With us is Garrett Epps, a professor of law at the University of Baltimore, and also covers the Supreme Court for The Atlantic, and he is here to help us break it all down. Hi, Garrett.
Hey, great to be here.
What is the summary from your view of this decision? What's your takeaway?
Well, you know, I think that what the court majority has basically said is that the administration probably could have terminated this program if it wanted to, if it had put in the work required to do it, and that the process by which the administration decided to do away with DACA was so slapdash and cynical and basically just a sham that as in the census case a year ago, the Chief Justice, you know, who is the swing vote, basically said, you know, I may be dumb, but I'm not stupid. I'm not falling for this. You didn't do the work you were supposed to do. And in particular, he says, the administration did not consider the impact this decision was going to have on the lives of the so-called Dreamers, the DACA recipients. You know, and then he outlines some of the things that have been going on in their lives, that they're in school, that they hold important jobs, that they have American citizen children. And he basically says, that doesn't mean you can't do it. He says, but the administration said they didn't even need to consider since they thought the program was illegal, they didn't have to consider the effect on the recipients. And that's really quite important, especially because the opinion is careful not to say that the government had illegitimate motives or that it was inspired by racism. There's a Justice Sotomayor, one of the five in the majority, drops out of that part. She writes a separate opinion saying, are you kidding me? Do you see the way Donald Trump talks about immigrants and people from south of the border? But that's only one vote. The court as a whole said, you know, this is just purely a procedural decision.
What does this mean now for those 700,000 and some DACA recipients? Are they now safe from deportation again?
Well, you know, DACA eligibility was never, you know, the equivalent of a green card. It didn't mean that you were entitled to remain in the United States unless there was some reason to remove you. It requires renewal every 2 years. And at present, the administration is going to have to continue, as it has under court order, it's going to have to continue accepting applications for extension, because a DACA recipient has to reapply every 2 years, and it's going to have to grant them to the recipients who meet the criteria. What this does is throw this decision, like so many other things about our country and its very basic nature, into the hopper for decision in November of this year, because the court's opinion, you know, consciously or not, provides a roadmap for the administration to take if they really want to go after DACA. I think that what really was going on was that the administration wanted to pretend that DACA was illegal, and it wasn't doing this voluntarily. It was just being forced to by the law. Mm. And the Supreme Court says that dog won't hunt, because you know, the legal authorities you were relying on don't say what you said they said. DACA may be illegal, but it hasn't been decided, and you can't pretend you're not making this decision and blame it on the courts.
In Sotomayor's portion that you described, she said, quote, taken together, the words of the president helped to create the strong perception that the rescission decision was contaminated by impermissible discriminatory animus. What does that mean, and what significance is it when one justice writes their own portion of a decision?
Well, this is very similar to what happened with the travel ban case, because, of course, in the travel ban case, the issue was also these extensive history of bigoted and hostile statements that Donald Trump had made both before and after becoming president, and to what extent should the court pay attention to those when the administration says, well, here's our travel ban, and see, it's neutral, it doesn't say anything bad about Muslims. And the court in that case said that they were going to approve the travel ban and not pay any attention to what the president said. Now, in the same thing is going on in this case, but there are only four justices for that approach. And what's fascinating is, of course, that it's Chief Justice Roberts, and then the court's other three liberals, so-called, Justices Breyer, Kagan, and Ginsburg, who join in that. So there's some indication to me that there's a little bit of brokering back and forth, that the Chief Justice did not want to tag the administration with the label of racism. And that label would have made it much harder to rescind DACA again if the president is elected to a second term. So it to some extent limits the force of the decision. But I hasten to add, this is a very sweeping and important decision. I'm not belittling it at all. It's just fascinating to see how reluctant the court is to say what most people really perceive, which is that the president has inspired by animus against the immigrants from below south of the border.
This Supreme Court has been described as a conservative court, but we get this decision in which the Chief Justice joins the majority in a 5-4 decision supporting the rights of immigrants. We got the earlier ruling protecting LGBTQ workers. Have experts been misreading the makeup, at least the political makeup of the court?
Well, I don't think that that's the case. I mean, I think that, you know, there are two classes of cases. There's the ordinary run of cases that include things like civil rights. And then there are the administration cases. This is an administration case. President Trump was asking the court to bless something he had done and say that he could go forward with a policy. This administration has an absolutely rock-solid block of four justices who are administration judges. You know, I swear if Donald Trump wanted to blow up Mount Rushmore, four justices would say that was a perfectly good thing to do. And you have, of course, the four moderate liberals who are really very suspicious of this administration. And then the Chief Justice is in the middle. When you have a case like the Title VII case that was decided earlier this week, in which the court said that Title VII prohibits discrimination against on the basis of sexual orientation or transgender status, the administration, you know, took a side in that case. They were opposed to having Title VII extend to that, but it wasn't a Donald Trump case.
Yeah.
And in that case, you know, judges do have their own judicial philosophies. Justice Gorsuch is a very strong proponent of a certain kind of reading of statutes.
Yeah.
And that reading led him in the direction of finding that the statute did, in fact, cover this kind of discrimination. Mm. Interesting to watch there, of course, is that the Chief Justice also joined that opinion, making it a 6-3. But that's kind of a different judicial politics thing. It's not anything that helps or hurts Trump. It's not anything that helps or hurts the Republican Party.
Right.
And that, I think, is where the fault lines are.
I want to say thank you to Garrett Epps, professor of law at the University of Baltimore, also covers the Supreme Court for The Atlantic. Garrett, thank you so much.
Great to talk to you.
After a quick break, we'll get into how we're talking to children about racism, police brutality, and safety. More in just a moment. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is 1A.
This message comes from NPR sponsor LegalZoom. We're all faced with new challenges these days. If you need legal help for yours, count on LegalZoom. Have questions about setting up a will or a living trust? Do you want to start a business as a DBA or LLC? LegalZoom can help. You can start online, and their network of attorneys can provide advice when you need it. And since LegalZoom isn't a law firm, you don't have to leave your home, and you won't get charged by the hour. Visit LegalZoom.com today for more information.
Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or perfect strangers? You can get all the facts you need to be up to speed on the 1A News Roundup. Find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
For James McBride, racism in this country has been a disease.
It's been the cancer that has just been killing us. And now we want to address the problem. I mean, you can't address the cancer until you know you have it. And these people are seeing the cancer.
Author James McBride on protests, a pandemic, and his new book. Listen to It's Been a Minute from NPR.
This is 1A. I'm Celeste Headlee. Last month, the entire nation watched as a man lay dying beneath the knee of a police officer. It was difficult to watch, even for adults. So how do you explain that to a child? Some parents tell their kids again and again that if they're in trouble, they should run to a police officer. So how do you explain that the police can sometimes be a threat? It can be tempting to think you can protect your children from discussions about George Floyd or Ahmaud Arbery or Breonna Taylor or Tamir Rice or Tatiana Jefferson or any of the others who've died violently at the hands of police officers. But any parent knows that kids are watching, and they see more than we want them to. For Black kids, this isn't just a lesson about politics. It's a necessary discussion about safety and possibly a call to action to join other Black youth at a protest. How do you talk to a Black child about the Black Lives Matter movement when they may have never realized there are people who think their lives don't matter? It's a lot. 1A correspondent Sasha Ann Simons has had many conversations with her daughters about racial slurs, systemic racism, policing, and the Black Lives Matter movement. When she asked her 12-year-old about what the movement is about, Mikhail said, "It's a, quote, movement to make everybody equal, especially Black lives, because people disrespect them, and they still do, which is really sad," end quote. Having to grapple with the possibility of violence at such a young age can have lasting impacts on a child's mind. 1A correspondent Sasha Ann Simon spoke with some young protesters and psychologist Rita Walker to find out what those impacts are.
No justice, no peace! No justice, no peace!
A viral video captures a 7-year-old Black girl marching in a New York protest, chanting with a scowl on her face, piercing brown eyes, her tiny fists swinging in the air, demanding the protection of Black lives.
No justice, no peace. No justice, no peace.
It's a moment that should never have happened, but here we are. Winta Amore is the quintessential young Black girl, complete with a missing front tooth, her hair in cornrows with pretty white beads fixed on the ends. But on that day in Long Island, Winta Amore was wise well beyond her 7 years. After George Floyd, a Black man, was killed by a white Minnesota police officer, anger and outrage among Black Americans spread from the grown-ups who've seen it all before to the next generation, bearing the burden of putting an end to it.
And my life matters, and my world matters.
Well, the people that say Black lives matter, it made me proud, happy. It made me feel like I was, a person.
We're peacefully protesting.
I believe that everyone should be treated equally, no matter what color they are.
We're trying to make people like know that we are going to make history doing this.
We don't want to do any harm. All we want to do is be heard.
11-year-old Jeremiah, a Black boy in Washington, D.C., has cerebral palsy and uses a wheelchair to get around. Still, he attended protests with mom and dad.
And what are we in front of?
The White House.
And what's going on out here?
We're protesting because a white man killed a Black man named by George Floyd.
And is that injustice?
No peace.
In Black families, the race talk comes early, and it's painful. It's not optional because there's this odd transition where children of color are no longer viewed as cute kids. Rather, some see them as threats. It's a conversation I'm having in my home where I'm raising my two daughters. They're 12 and 13, excited to explore the world around them, unafraid to speak their minds.
When I say Black Lives Matter, what do you think of?
It's a movement to make everybody equal, especially Black lives, because people disrespect them, and they still do, which is really sad.
My teenager gets most of her updates from social media apps. It was on TikTok where she first witnessed the officer kneel on George Floyd's neck, killing him. She's watched that video so many times, and other videos of Black men and women killed by police. And though my daughter hasn't been to a protest, she's fighting the cause virtually.
Literally, it got to the point where I couldn't scroll and find anything non-related to Black Lives, to the Black Lives Matter or protesting or George Floyd. But there was also a lot of All Lives Matter people on there. I literally have replied to so many comments. Yeah, I had to put people in their place.
I've had to put restrictions on the girls' social media use. I talk with them about the unrest playing out across the country, the ugly history of systemic racism in America. And I try to assure them that they'll be safe to walk the streets and drive a car without fear of being hurt by police. And as their mother, who's a Black woman, who also happens to be a news reporter, I know this is all just too much for them to bear.
You can't have a certain level of psychological well-being when you're dealing with racism on a day-to-day basis and not even recognizing it.
Dr. Rita Walker is a psychology professor at the University of Houston. She's also the author of The Unapologetic Guide to Black Mental Health. She says Black households are experiencing a high level of stress. Anxiety levels are up, depression is on the rise, and they're just plain exhausted.
When parents aren't at their best, it is that much more difficult to help their child who is also struggling but may not even have the words to communicate what it is that they're dealing with. And so the child may themselves feel anxious if they've seen the news and have heard about these stories. And some children are being exposed to this trauma for the first time. And so they really don't understand or have words because adults don't have the words to explain what's going on right now.
There isn't a roadmap for raising kids, let alone talking to them about racism. And to parents trying to decide whether it's okay for the kids to protest, Walker says it depends on the child.
If a child says, you know, I want to be out there and this is important to me, to make sure that there's a conversation about the expectations. Like, what do they expect is going to happen as a result of being out there? Like, what does this mean to them? Like, keeping the dialogue open, not just before the event and during the event, but also after the event. To process.
I met up with Zion Kelly at one of several Black Lives Matter protests in D.C. this month. He's 19.
I mean, I've been passionate about that issue and different issues that impact, you know, us minorities, especially Black people here in America, because, you know, we don't get a fair shot. You know, we have to overcome, you know, so many obstacles just to become successful, just to move forward in life.
His twin brother was shot and killed in 2017, and Zion has been on the front lines protesting against gun violence ever since. He supports the current movement to defund the police, and Zion is working to ignite the same passion in others.
Me and a couple of my friends, we plan on holding conversations, talking to different Black men and different youth, you know, to inspire them and to get them, you know, active in their community and thinking about, you know, who they are, their identity, and, you know, educating themselves so we can move forward as a Black community.
Alexis Jones is an 18-year-old activist in D.C. Her fight for change began at her high school when she joined a gun violence intervention group.
Gun violence, police brutality, it's all related. So it's kind of frustrating to me personally that it's like everybody's like, oh my gosh, this is happening. It's been happening. Like, it's nothing new.
It's easy for protesters on the front lines to let the unrest and trauma take over their lives. At times like this, self-care is key. And though that can be hard to do, both Alexis and Zion say they're giving it a try.
I've learned how to mentally cope with things not going necessarily how you would envision them to go. But it has been like very, I'm trying to think of the word, like I felt hopeless at times, knowing that I'm never going to stop fighting. Like this is all I've ever wanted to do is to help people.
I do take naps. But I work out. I like to run, jog, and I listen to music. That really is a form of self-care to me.
For parents of younger kids, Dr. Walker has this advice for easing that mental toll.
Maybe third or fourth grade or older, being available to communicate, even if the child says, I don't want to talk about this, or I don't know, you know, the common response, or nothing, to say, you know, I am here whenever you're ready to talk, and I love you. For a younger child, maybe just being available to play, whatever creative play that they come up with, you know, to be present. So I think the easiest thing that any parent can do, besides making sure they're okay, is to be present.
And if your children are still having trouble processing their thoughts and feelings in this moment, Walker says it might be time to pursue some professional help. For 1A, I'm Sasha Ann Simons.
Up next, if you've avoided talking to your kids about race until now, it's probably time to stir up your courage and have the conversation. Don't worry, we have expert advice to help you get through it. I'm Celeste Headley. You're listening to 1A.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Facebook. It's a challenging time for small businesses in communities across the country. Facebook's Business Resource Hub offers free tools to help manage a business, support customers and employees, and connect with other business owners who are facing similar challenges. From information on how to bring a business online to setting up a customer service plan, Facebook's Business Resource Hub can provide resources. Learn more at facebook.com/resource.
Throughout America's history, small choices have compounded into big inequalities. I'm Manoush Zomorodi. How Injustice Gets Ingrained. That's on the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Subscribe or listen now.
I'm Celeste Headley. There's a conversation that every parent needs to have with their kids, and I'm not talking about the birds and the bees. I'm talking about race. For Black parents, discussing race and racism is not a choice. That talk has to happen at a young age. But many white kids can go their entire childhoods without ever having a real conversation about racism, and that possibly is because white adults can avoid talking about race if they really want to, while Black adults can't. White parents who tell their children not to see color are not helping. Schools that have run-of-the-mill Black History Month programs are not doing enough. Joining me now to discuss how we should speak to our kids about race and racism is author, illustrator, and filmmaker Vashti Harrison. She's the number one New York Times bestselling author, illustrator of Little Leaders, Bold Women in Black History, and many other titles, including Hair Love. Vashti, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Nia Hurd-Garris is a pediatrician and researcher at the Anne and Robert H. Lurie Children's Hospital of Chicago and Northwestern University. She's also chair of the section on minority health, equity, and inclusion at the American Academy of Pediatrics. Dr. Hurd-Garris, welcome to 1A.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And Bettina Love is professor of educational theory and practice at the University of Georgia and author of We Want to Do More Than Survive, Abolitionist Teaching and the Pursuit of Educational Freedom. Professor Love, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So, Dr. Hurd-Garris, you were a guest on the CNN Sesame Street Town Hall. It was called Coming Together, Standing Up to Racism. Let's take a listen.
Our friend has a question.
I want to be a neurosurgeon when I grow up. Can I operate on racist brains to change them?
Oh, Dr. Hurd-Garris, I want to tell Kyle yes, but you are the medical professional here, so I'm going to leave that one to you.
Absolutely. As doctors, and I'm so excited you're going to join us, you operate and you care for everyone, no matter their attitudes. But with that being said, we are working really, really, really hard to change people's hearts and minds and policy so that later on you don't have to operate on racist people's brains. You can operate knowing that everyone is behind you and rooting for you.
So, Doctor, I don't know how much we know about whether racism can be inherited. I'm assuming it can't. But we do know that racism, when it's present in a community or in a society, it can have negative impacts on children's development. Is that correct?
Absolutely. While kids are in school around age 9 and 10, their attitudes towards race, racial identity, racism, and the like are really starting to solidify. And it takes essentially life-changing experiences to challenge or rethink those beliefs and behavior. So it's really important to start to have those kind of conversations before then. But certainly once children are exposed to racism, and that can be directly, so hearing a name being called or witnessing, you know, racially charged events on TV or social media, those things can absolutely impact their mental health primarily. But we're starting to see more research that's done in the physical health space too. So when we say mental health, you know, we're thinking about depression and anxiety, as well as PTSD, and then behaviors. So having more aggressive behaviors, but also becoming more withdrawn. So there's a myriad of health impacts that racism can have, either on the child directly by being a victim of racism, or indirectly by hearing about it or witnessing it or seeing it in some other way.
I have a question from Olga, who says, my 5-year-old has his mind set on being a police officer right now, so we've been talking to him a lot about being just and protecting people. I feel bad because with the endless whys, I come to a dead end. Sorry, buddy, I don't know why. I don't know why people are mean to each other. I have no good explanation for him. Vashti, how can art like yours answer whys for people? How does the art, the books that you make, and other authors step in at this point?
I think just that the process of understanding how other people throughout history have experienced their lives, I think will help kind of open up our ideas for what is possible for each of ourselves. So in my third book, Little Legends, Exceptional Men in Black History, I tell the story of Bass Reeves, who was one of the first black deputy U.S. marshals in the States. And so it's a story about a cop. But what I tried to showcase was that he used his ingenuity and his quick thinking to solve problems, and he actively tried not to use violence. He used traps to catch bad guys. So I want to kind of showcase that there are ways that we can use our skills, we can use the things that are inside of us to help the world around us and to help other people. And so I know that there are going to be questions, and I don't think any of us have all the answers, but I think it's important to understand that that's okay, and that we can work towards getting there one step at a time.
We do have questions about schools from our listeners. And let me start with you, Professor Love. Sailor tweets this: I did my best as a white teacher of mostly black students, but I always had to do my own research to be able to teach about black figures in U.S. history who were not slaves. The textbooks basically leave it at MLK, Harriet Tubman, and slavery. What advice do you have for teachers?
So I think the first thing teachers have to understand, and sadly, is that we don't do enough in teacher education programs to prepare teachers to go out and be what we call culturally relevant, right? So to be culturally relevant means that you have studied black and brown folks' culture. And so we want teachers to go out into the classroom and talk about black history, but honestly, they haven't been learned any black history. I can go through my entire teacher education program and not take one class in African American history. And so she's right. Much of the work she has to do will be on her own. And so what I try to tell my students is that start building a database. And I'm not saying that you have to read everything today, but just have a running document of documentaries, of articles, of books, and start to have conversations with your coach, other teachers. Hey, have you read this? Have you thought about this? Start building your database. Start building places where you can go and feel comfortable to start having conversations about these things. But it is going to be for a teacher to try on his or her own to learn a lot, because we just don't do a great job in teacher education programs telling the rich and beautiful history about Black and Brown folks.
So, Dr. Hurd-Garris, how do you see this as a positive? And I approach this question especially because you are in the medical field. A lot of times when you think about having discussions about race, it can feel very heavy. It can feel like a burden. Sometimes people tell me that they feel dread about it. Are there benefits to it that might give it a more positive reflection?
No, I think that's an interesting question, one that I haven't been asked before, but I appreciate it because I think there are positives. And I think one of the big positives is that it feels like now that this massive problem that's been in the consciousness of Black and Brown folks for a very long time has now entered white consciousness and then more just the public space. It feels like that there is this energy and this tide that hopefully things will actually change. And I think one of the things I think about is giving something a name. So I think it's really hard when you have different symptoms of a medical illness and you go to different doctors and you're trying to say, this is what's going on, this is what's going on, and people can't give it a name. But somehow when you get a name for an illness, you get a name for a disease or whatever, there's power that comes with that, because then you can learn about it, you can do something about it, you can talk about it, you can join other support groups for it. And so I think with us finally being able to name the problem and us being society, naming that there is a problem empowers us to then do something about it. And so I think that's one of the biggest positives. I really feel like this energy is different than it's been in the past. And so that's my hope.
Annette writes this: we assumed it was a good thing if we didn't talk about race with our kids, if we didn't draw attention to race as an important distinguishing characteristic about people. We made a point of watching Sesame Street and not mentioning racial or ethnic differences. I think we managed to raise non-racist kids, but we would have benefited from this discussion. It's only white parents who have the luxury of trying to raise colorblind children. So in the minute or so that we have left, Professor Love, I want to ask you that same question. Instead of seeing this as a conversation that parents have to dread, are there things to look forward to in this discussion?
So I think that's a really wonderful question. And I just want to end by saying that when we think about Black folks, we think about trauma and pain and death. And that's part of the Black experience, but that isn't everything. And so we also got to make sure as parents that we're giving a full story. And so for me, I find joy in helping teachers and parents see the fullness of Black life beyond just trauma and death.
That is University of Georgia professor Bettina Love. We also spoke with pediatrician and researcher Dr. Nia Hurd-Garris and author and illustrator Vashti Harrison. Vashti's books include Little Leaders, Bold Women in Black History, Little Dreamers, Visionary Women Around the World, and Little Legends, Exceptional Men in Black History. And Professor Bettina Love's book is called We Want to Do More Than Survive, Abolitionist Teaching and the Pursuit of Educational Freedom. Thanks all of you for your insight and expertise today. This conversation was produced by Danielle Knight and Charlotte Freeland and edited by Matthew Simonson. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, visit the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Celeste Headley. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.